everyone. Thank you for tuning in to my second episode of Behind the Curtain. I'm your host, Anna Nordmo, and I'm really looking forward to talking to my guest today, Alpen Hong. I first saw Alpen in a concert when I was in elementary school, and this was the first time I can recall ever being truly starstruck. Alpen Hong is a concert pianist who has played in glamorous locations like the Walt Disney Hall, the White House, and Carnegie Hall. He has soloed with major orchestras across the country and dazzled young audiences like me in his kid-friendly concerts as well. Alpen is a multifaceted artist who is known for his charisma, his sense of humor, and strong personality on stage. He has a TED Talk on how to be a performer that has received almost 300,000 views on YouTube, and also frequently is involved in artist-in-residence programs as an advocate for arts education. Alpen, I am so excited to chat with you today. Welcome to the podcast.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's a privilege to be on with you. And it's just personally so fulfilling to me to hear that I had such an impact in you as a young person, to see you grow up into like such a successful musician, but also like a whole person. So it's very gratifying for me to be here. So thank you so much.
I think where I would like to start is from the very beginning. So can you tell us a little bit about when you started playing piano and kind of how that journey began?
I get this from a lot of kids. They ask me, how did you start playing music? And the honest answer is my mom made me. And this is a kind of, to be the honest answer for probably a lot of kids during the 80s and certainly beforehand. So my parents, they were immigrants from South Korea, arrived here in 1972. My father was a doctor. My mother was a homemaker. And they started me on piano and violin lessons in Suzuki, you know, Mississippi gumdrops, like anyone else with the box yep. and the stick. I always thought that she was kind of the music lover in the family. And she was the performer out of the two of them. She played guitar and piano and had a really great singing voice. And she just had a very ebullient personality. My dad was a very introverted. He actually was a family psychiatrist. But now that I look back, I remember that, and I just inherited a whole bunch of his old opera LPs. And I remember him coming home from work, you know, very tired, and he would put on some opera and he would transform. Like he would turn into this kind of operatic hero. He would belt out these arias quite badly. And then he would scoop me and my brother and he would chase us around and he would hug us that way. And so I realized that this music had a lot of meaning for him. So that probably had a part of the reason why they started me and my younger brother on piano and violin. And actually, I don't know what made them do this, but they invested and bought me this piano I'm sitting in front of right now. This is the piano they bought me when I was 4 years old in 1980. It is a Yamaha C7 Concert Grand, and is the same piano that I have today. I've learned every single piece I've ever learned in my life on this thing. And so it has been everywhere from Michigan to Los Angeles to San Francisco to New York City to Brooklyn, and now has finally come to its home here in Honolulu, Hawaii. So yeah, that's the main reason. I think they probably did it because they considered classical music to be Western civilization's ultimate achievement. It was what a lot of immigrants during that time probably considered to be a part of the American dream, to have a piano in their home, to be able to give their kids piano and violin lessons, which is certainly something that a lot of parents, when they were growing up, did not have the resources to do.
Yeah, that's very relatable for me. Obviously, I started violin when I was 2.5, I believe, and people are always asking me like, oh, you know, that's so amazing. And it's like, it didn't feel amazing when I was that young. Another thing I think we get asked a lot as musicians, and I'm going to ask this just because I think it's an interesting question, but you know, people never ask like financial analysts, oh, did you know you wanted to do this when you were really young? But when was kind of the point when you thought that this could possibly be a career for you?
Interestingly enough, I was a pretty normal kid growing up. That is to say that I hated practicing. This was probably not helped by the fact that the Nintendo Entertainment System came out in 1986. I've said this many times in interviews that it's very hard for Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart to compete with Mario, Zelda, and Metroid growing up. So, you know, my mom really had to spank me to practice and would yell at me all the time. And I used to cheat a lot because I would learn things really quickly and I'd try to memorize them as quickly as I could, because I knew that if she just heard something come out of the piano, she assumed I was actually learning something. But what I would do is I would take the music stand, I would put a comic book, probably back then it was G.I. Joe and Transformers, and I would read it and I would just play like, you know, not paying attention at all, but, you know, I'm not learning anything. I'm just moving my fingers, right? But I'm actually focusing on something else. But I was that kid that I know a lot of young musicians, their parents would embarrassingly ask them to play for relatives that would come by or friends that would come have dinner or something. No, go play something for them. And you have to go up there and play for them. And I actually enjoyed that part. I actually didn't mind that at all. It didn't make me nervous. And so I think that it was that love of performance that lasted through, like I said, going to high school and going to college, all the things that happened to me from that point.
And you talk, so you're talking a little bit about these performances, and I was reading on your bio that you had won these big prestigious competitions and whatnot. And so can you kind of talk a little bit about that experience? I'm sure you did some competitions when you were younger, and was that like a positive thing for you?
I think it is a mixed bag, right? Because as a kid, there is the playground pecking order, right? Where depending on how you got picked for basketball or dodgeball or kickball or whatever it is, you knew how good you were, like on the totem pole. But it's kind of exacerbated if, like, as a young child, you're subjected to a competition where you're being rated with all the kids in your state. Or as I started to experience when I was about 8 years old, I started doing international competitions in nearby Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, you know, that I was meeting kids from Korea, Russia, Japan, France, and these, you know, young prodigies that would come and compete in these competitions. So I think that my competitive nature may have been sparked by that. I think it was mostly positive, because I think that what has really helped me in other areas of my life is learning and accepting the idea of risk. That live musicianship and live auditioning, if you do that as a young person, you learn to regulate your inner nerves and this idea that you can fail. And they always say that losing is actually a better lesson than winning. And I really, really do believe that you have to be able to learn to lose, to really appreciate what it is to win and what it takes to win. So there is an example for this, is that I entered this competition called the Stravinsky Competition, International Piano Competition. And this was held, as I said, in Illinois. And I think I was probably 8 the first time I went. And that was when I met my nemesis. Her name was Janae Codner. She was this little Mormon girl from Provo, Utah. And she obliterated me, like obliterated me. Like I came with my little like sonatina to this thing. I was like, yeah, I play the sonatina well. She brought the Chopin Winter Wind Etude, okay? Which I would maintain most adults screw that thing up. Most adults can't just whip that thing out. And I remember, because my mom, she had heard that this girl was homeschooled and practiced 10 hours a day. And of course, like to an Asian mom, I mean, that's like meeting your Thanos. Like it's like, this girl must be defeated, you know, for the pride of so much, our family, our entire country, you know. And so that sense of competition, you know, as a kid, it was very high stakes, right? I learned to be very, very, very nervous, and, you know, to await, you know, who won, and to know the crushing disappointment of losing. And this girl did blow me out 3 years in a row. So I got to have this experience of getting hammered into the ground over and over again, until I actually managed to finally win the competition when I was 12. But the sad part of that was that she, even though she was the same age as me, won the category above me. So, you know, it never ends. It's like there is no victory, right? Except for what you make for yourself.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So you talk about these memorable experiences when you were young. And I'm wondering, when you were young, you obviously knew that this was kind of something spectacular that you had that, you know, maybe other kids did not experience. Are there moments that stick out to you in your memory that were not like the normal experience, like maybe a wedding that you played or a gig that you think fondly or maybe not so fondly of?
Yeah, you know, in terms of like a doorway opening to an experience I might not have had or appreciated if not for music, was I grew up in Battle Creek, Michigan, and I was raised in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. My parents were baptized into this church when I was young. And so we would go to this church, and there was a Korean part of the church, and then there was like the white people's part of the church. And, you know, because I didn't speak Korean very well at all, we would sneak as the kids. And would go sit in the white people's church and then listen to the sermon there. And strangely enough, the African-American population in Battle Creek had their own separate church called the Berean Church. And because of my musicianship, they would ask me to go play special music over there. And so I actually got introduced to African-American culture and African-American people that I wouldn't necessarily have encountered any place else. My third grade teacher happened to be Black, and so she was the one that initially invited me to the church, but I became kind of a repeat guest because they loved having me there. They loved having me play special music. But I was able to see just kind of a cultural uniqueness of what a Black church was like and how much it's, and both the similarities and differences that it had with the other, the Korean church and the white church. So it really opened my eyes to kind of the cultural differences that were there. And I really, really appreciate that, because I think that's a central part of music, that if you're open to it and you're truly invested in it, its greatest gift is allow you to meet and encounter and have relationships with people that you otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, I love that. It's definitely such a connector of many people, and we get that unique experience. So
yeah.
I also want to talk a little bit about your education in college. But before that, I thought it would be interesting to hear about your experience. You know, you had early experience in these competitions that you obviously did very well in. And there must have been a teacher or somebody that stands out that really, you know, helped you and supported you throughout your journey.
Yeah, I would say that I had four major teachers in my life that really, really stick out. The first one is Peggy Hagel. She was the first one who started teaching me when I was four. She was the one that had me play a full recital by myself when I was five. And I remember I had a picture in the newspaper from when I was 5 years old, and the tagline is, "He can't reach an octave, but he can jump one." And it's just a little five-year-old kid. And then later on, as my teachers and my parents felt that I had outgrown her, we found, I consider to be one of the best developmental teachers in the world at that time. His name is Emilio Del Rosario. He taught out of what was then the North Shore School of Music in Chicago. And so my mom, just to give you an idea of my mom's and mother's and father's dedication to my music making, they would drive us 7 hours round trip so that I could have a 2-hour lesson with this man every Sunday. And so, you know, that idea of like that amount of sacrifice just for my music making was quite extraordinary at the time. After that, the thing that kind of marked probably the fork in the road for me is that, you know, I've been talking a lot about how my parents are very much kind of the wellspring of why I started piano, and their dedication to it is what allowed me to maybe have a level of training that other kids might not have. And I lost my parents when I was 12 in an auto accident, as you might know. And that was the fork in the road where I think I was considering giving up my musicianship completely, because I was moving to a new place. My aunt and uncle that adopted me did not have the time, as much time as my mom did as a homemaker, to be able to just take me all these lessons. So I had to give up the violin, which I'd also played for 8 years prior to that. And so that idea of what a teacher is to me changed too, because we didn't really know. But we were able to find a really amazing teacher. His name is Mark Richman. And the funny thing is how we found him, he actually was teaching one on my other nemesis from when I was younger in competitions. His name is Eric Huebner, and he's a friend of mine still. And he's the pianist for the New York Philharmonic and just an absolutely brilliant, brilliant pianist. He just released an album of Ligeti Etudes, all of them. It's unbelievable. So, you know, Mark Richman is probably the third one. And I'd say that the way I do it is my first teacher started me. The second one gave me my hands. The third one gave me my ear, Mark Richman. And my fourth one was Jerome Lowenthal at Juilliard that showed me how much left I had to learn. So he was just kind of the one that showed me, well, I thought the bar was here, but every time I would reach it, he would show me that there was something more.
Can you talk a little bit more about this teacher-student relationship? Because I think this is really unique to something in music, and it's not like, oh, I had this teacher in third grade, or, you know, even the professor relationship, it's just such a different experience. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think that it is, in a way, the most intimate relationship you have as a young person growing up outside of your parents. And in some ways, even more. I'm going to explain that. You know, your parents, because they love you and they are your parents, when they criticize you, for example, there's a level, I know, even as hard as parents can be, there's a level of which that they usually take into account that they're still your parents. And so that authority comes from a different place than a teacher does. Because the teacher's entire job is not to love you. It is to improve you. And that gave a lot of teachers, I think, license to be much harsher on us than certainly modern parents allow any teacher to be on their precious child.
Yes,
they
totally.
They would just cry. And this was the one time where the parents wouldn't be like, oh, that terrible teacher. They'd be like, what's wrong with you? Like, you know, that's your fault. You should have practiced more. That's why you're crying. Crying is good for you, you know? So I think that relationship is very unique. And I don't want to make a caricature out of it, but it is true. I think there are parallels in like dance and sports, which is another thing that people start very early, that the idea of coach. And that becomes a very kind of sacred relationship, this one-on-one teacher, this Luke and Yoda relationship that actually is, I think, in a way, with the best teachers, where they're not actually teaching you just how to, you know, swing a lightsaber, but they're teaching you about life, right? The best ones. And so I think that that is something unique. And it's, I think it's a unique responsibility that music teachers have to their students that I think the great ones really take on, that they understand that you are molding a young person's personality and ability to express themselves. That is even more than the musicianship that you might be picking up.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And this experience, of course, has been similar with me as well. So I want to move a little bit now. You went to college at Juilliard, the one school that everybody in the world knows. And I feel like music school, you know, is regarded as this college experience, but is really fundamentally different from a normal college experience. So can you talk a little bit about your time at Juilliard and how that kind of molded you into a concert pianist?
Yes, I would love to do that. The quick thing is that the way that I quickly describe Juilliard to people is that it is a strange place because it's got your normal people that you find at every school. You've got your freaks, your geeks, your jocks, your party animals. You know, you've got them all, your nerds. But everyone you pass is extraordinary at something. And so this person you might discount is just like, oh, this dork. When you find out like what they do and what they can do, it really causes you to kind of just like, you know, a lot of houses of cards are kind of blown away by that. And I'm going to use where I went to college, UCLA, as the kind of a polar opposite experience of the one I had in New York at Juilliard. So I originally, because I'm a Korean American male, of course, I decided to try to go to medical school. That's what I'm genetically bred to do. And so I actually, growing up prior to that in high school, I went to a rather small, prestigious private high school called Crossroads School for the Arts and Sciences. I got a scholarship to this school. And this school is very famous because a lot of Hollywood producers and actors went there and their kids go there now. Like Jack Black went there and the cast of the Wonder Years went there. Kate Hudson, Emily Deschanel, and she was my grade. And so I grew up in this kind of a Hollywood place. And so then I got dropped into UCLA, one of the biggest public universities in the world. And I just kind of like got thrown in the shark tank. And very clueless and kind of mistakenly going into pre-medical studies because I felt like that was what was expected of me. And so it was a very hard decision to break away from that pre-medical track and then decide to take a risk and jump off my medical track and apply to the Juilliard School, which at the time was, I think, the second most exclusive school in the nation other than the Air Force Academy in terms of the percentage of applicants that they accepted. And when I got there, obviously, it's weird because I played classical music my whole life, but I didn't listen to it a whole lot. So I didn't really know how much legacy there was that resided there outside of the music department, like the theater department. People like, you know, actors like Lawrence Fishburne went there and Robin Williams went there. Anthony Mackie, who was Falcon in the Marvel movies, went there. He was like a friend of ours while we were there. And so this idea that everyone there is really extraordinary at something, there is something very, very special about that. I think the name brandedness of the school, I didn't realize what that was until after I graduated, and understanding what the cachet of a name like that is, as a lot of Ivy Leaguers find going to Harvard and Yale and Princeton and all the schools that our parents try to get us to go to. Again, like, it was the most amazing experience for me because of where it was located, at Lincoln Center, Manhattan. It was because of being there that I got a chance to see my first major orchestra perform something. And mine happened to be the Vienna Philharmonic playing Mahler Fifth Symphony. It was the first concert at that level I'd seen, and I got to see it at Carnegie Hall. So there's always this, you have to go Carnegie, practice, this goal of being there. And I was sitting there as an audience member, listening to arguably one of the greatest orchestras in the world play one of the most titanic pieces ever created by a genius. And, you know, it has surround sound trumpets that when they started playing it, like, freaked me out. I was like, it was like a THX Dolby effect. Like, what is happening? And I caused me to fall in love with this art form that I had learned my whole life, but had never appreciated its tradition and its level of excellence until then. So I think that's really what Juilliard gave to me. It showed me what a world-class standard looked and sounded like. And I realized very quickly, I was not at that standard. I remember my very first studio class. I was sitting there with a studio of maybe 20, 25 students in Jerry Lowenthal's class. And it was our first studio class. And of course, he's like, well, would anyone like to play something for us today? Now, who's going to volunteer on day one at Juilliard to get up and just play a piece for a studio class? That person is certifiably nuts. So obviously none of us are raising our hand. And then this guy, Vasily Primakov, he was this tall Russian dude, and he looked like Dracula a little bit because he dressed all in black and he was like thin and tall and kind of like this. And he went up and played Schumann Carnival for us, this 30-minute crazy piece. Just, it got harder and harder and harder, and he got better and better and better. At the end, I was just like, I don't belong here. Why am I here? And so I spent actually the next 2 years, I think, trying to live up to what I perceived as the standard, like the world-class standard that was there. And so that was what was uniquely special about that place.
How do you think you transitioned out of this, you know, student mentality? You've got juries and recitals to prepare for, into just being shot out into the real world, having to figure out how to make a living and survive as a musician.
I have a good story behind that, actually. So in my last semester of my second year there, which was my last year in my master's program, I took a career skills seminar class. It was just a purely elective thing. No one took it. There were like six people in the class. But now that I've taken it, I realized I think this should be the only essential class that students at Juilliard take, because it was training us to do things that are absolutely indispensable to being a working musician today. Write a bio, make a recording, program a concert, learn to introduce yourself, stand up and verbally introduce yourself, apply for jobs, apply for competitions. And so the textbook of this was written by, it was called Making Music in Looking Glass Land. That was the name of the book. And that book was commissioned by this outfit called Concert Artist Guild, which actually had a competition every 2 years. And this was a nonprofit management agency that the prize, if you won the competition, was $5,000, commission-free management for 3 years, and your debut in Carnegie Hall and a recording. And so as a whim, I decided to just apply for this competition. And so I actually ditched class like in spring to do it. And I went and auditioned and I fooled the jury and I won. And so I remember for finals, we were supposed to create this publicity packet for ourselves. That was the final of the class that I was taking. But Concert Artist Guild made it for me. And so I just got it from them and I like handed it in. So I like got an A in this class for like, I was supposed to enter a competition, make a bio, they made one for me. I had a recording in hand. And so like, I kind of like really jumped the moon on kind of what the class was supposed to teach me. So that's what shot me into my career. I actually managed to win a competition, which, you know, back in the day in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, competitions used to be the golden door of opportunity. You would win the Tchaikovsky competition, the Van Cliveren audition, and then thereafter you'd be invited to play by every major orchestra in the world, and you'd tour for the rest of your life, and then there you go, and you're done. Of course, now in today's age, nothing could be further than the truth that winning one of those competitions makes you the champion for 2 or 3 years, and then there's the next champion. And what you do with your award and the concert opportunities that you get define your ability to have sustainability going forward. And strangely enough, because of this competition win, before this, obviously, I had no assumption I was going to win this thing. So I had no idea what I was going to do when I got out. I was like, well, I could just go on the competition circuit. How am I going to pay for an apartment in New York City? Am I even going to stay in New York? I've got to. All my musician friends are here. And so I decided to work for an after-school music program for at-risk kids in Harlem. This is called Kitchen Sink Music. And this was actually after I won a Concert Artist Guild, because they decided to start this outreach program. And so I was one of the first winners that was invited to play for the kids, but I decided to stay on as a teacher. And because of this amazing program, I was, I think, able to see, first of all, what music education means to students that can't get it, and how essential it is, and how humanizing it can be, and how elevating it can be. So a lot of these kids, they were considered at risk because their homes were not considered safe to them to be in. Either there just was no parent there, or the parent was, you know, some of them were incarcerated. And so we would sit with them, we would do their homework. We wouldn't necessarily just teach them music. We would play games with them. We would do their homework with them. And then we started putting in some music curriculum into it. And through the course of this, I realized what musicianship is supposed to be outside of just the glittering stages of the great concert halls of the world. That is, for me, it was a gift given by relatively affluent parents. As I told you before, I don't know why they started me in this, but you know, there are certain cultural things, there are certain expectations they may have of what a success in America looked like. But for some of these kids, I actually do believe that their ability to learn to enjoy learning is a lifesaver. It might have been the only thing where they felt valuable and where they felt seen. And so that's why when my music performing career started, I started to try to ask and request and search for opportunities to do educational outreach no matter where I was. It could be a tiny town of, you know, 7,000, 8,000 people in Texas, which is where I would do this. And I would just go to the local high school and play for their choir, you know, because they didn't have enough instruments for band or orchestra, certainly orchestra, but I could play for choir. And I really fell in love with that. And I think that has defined my career going forward.
Yeah, I remember so vividly when I was young, my parents would sometimes bring me to these orchestra concerts, or they, you know, Kalamazoo is where I'm from, is yeah. This great little music community. And we have amazing artists passing by all the time. But of course, as a young child, you don't really recognize that. You're falling asleep, you know, you get snacks during the intermission, and then you fall back asleep. And the most memorable experience from when I was younger was this concert that you did. And I can't remember how it was marketed, or I think it was must have been part of the Gilmore Festival or something that you play a large role in. But what was so fascinating to me was you found a way to make it a story time. You know, you were telling stories about how you would play your piano and kids would come trick-or-treating at your house in Halloween. And yes. Yeah.
Right. Oh yeah, you remember that
exactly.
Story.
Yeah, that was so like. I remember just I was like, "Oh, mom, I don't want to get dragged to this other concert," and she was like, "No, I promise you, this is going to be great." And it was truly spectacular. That was the first time, you know, I went back and actually was like excited to practice. And so I kind of wanted to hear about how you came to be this onstage presence, you know, where you're totally going beyond what a normal concert pianist would maybe be, which is you solo with the big orchestras, you play your concerto, you do that, and you get the flowers and everything. But your performance was just so much greater than that and had an impact on me and certainly many other kids in the audience. So I wanted to hear about that and also how you came to be prepared to be that kind of stage presence. You know, I don't, at least in my experience, didn't receive that kind of training for being able to tell stories and make the audience laugh and stuff like that.
Well, thank you so much. Again, it is the greatest joy and the greatest gift to hear that somebody like you got that experience from one of my shows. I will say that actually it's not through performance practice that I learned about how to do this or had the desire to do this. It was actually from being in the audience that made me want to be this. And I'm going to give one example. It was not a classical concert that made me want to do this. It was a rock concert. I got to see Smashing Pumpkins in New York in college. I actually won tickets. I won plane tickets, hotel, and tickets to a private show that they're having in their hometown theater in Chicago, Smashing Pumpkins. This is when they had just released the double album, Bullet with Butterfly Wings, and they were the it band at the time. And I got to go and be in the front row. I watched them just absolutely slay it. And because this was their hometown theater, their family was there. So all of their families were there. They remember when they were just a bunch of garage band kids, you know, sucking in their garage. And now here they are launching the biggest rock album of all time and about to launch this tour. And throughout the whole time, the lead singer, he treated the whole concert as a story of how they grew up. And each song was building on this picture of who they are as people and who they are as a band. And that just absolutely blew me away. I was crying actually at some of the parts because he was talking about what it was like to be an angsty teenager who all of his love was unrequited, right? And who doesn't understand that, having a crush on someone who doesn't love you back? And I think that sense of love and envy and angst and all those kinds of things as a teenager, especially for like that kind of music that is about emotion and positive and negative, and how he channels it into the music and made us all feel it and made us remember what it was like to be like that, that never left me. And so when I started performing, and I initially performed like everybody else, I got up on stage, I bowed in my nice, you know, penguin suit, I bowed, you know, and then I got my check and I left. And another thing that I realized, I was looking at the audience, and as you know, the audience is mostly affluent older folks. And these are mostly classical lovers. And I was like, where is everyone else? Where are the kids? Where are the college students? Where are the 40-year-olds? You know, forget 16-year-olds. Where are the 45-year-olds? Right. And so I started to try to investigate what it was that made audiences tick. So I would put myself into all these weird places to play, bars. And I did a dinner show. You know, I played at a hospital, at a cancer ward. I played in an abused child's shelter. And I tried to find ways to connect to all these disparate audiences with the same music. You know, it's not like I brought different music. I would bring the same music, but the way that I introduced it, the way I introduced myself, the way I dressed, even that taught me little snippets about what is the most universal voice I can have to try to capture the most people and introduce this great art form to the most people that I can. And so I think that that's where my performance persona came from. It started by being an audience member, and then it started by putting myself into a lot of uncomfortable situations that were not necessarily meant for a classical piano.
For those of you who are listening, he does a great explanation of this and a demonstration really of something similar to what I saw when I was young and saw Alpen perform on YouTube. You can look up Alpen Hong on YouTube. It will definitely be the first video that comes up. And he talks about how to be a performer. And along that same lines, how does this lifestyle look like? You know, you've talked a little bit about, you know, you do the concerts, but you also have a strong foundation in outreach and things that do matter more to you, or maybe not more, but equally as much. And so what does that lifestyle look like? Like how, when things were normal, what was the balance and ebb and flow of these events?
I would say that my life was not in balance prior to this. When I was single, the balance was much easier because I could be on tour 7 months out of the year. And, you know, and I remember one year I did have 95 concerts in a row in 8 months in 38 states, you know, and I just drove myself to little town and stayed in every motel and hotel all the way from San Diego to Maine. So that was very exciting. It was doing exactly what I wished it could be. putting myself in unfamiliar situations and then convincing an audience to have a good time and then leaving victorious. You know, so that was really great. Balancing that with the educational part, that was the challenging part, right? Because as I just described to you, I was not good at this to start. No one is. I remember there was a really fail one that I did that made me realize the limitations of what I can do as an outreach performer. Let me just describe to you. So there was a boys and girls club that I played in, and they decided that I was going to play for them in the gym. And they had me on this little keyboard. They said, sorry, it doesn't have full 88 keys. It's 67 keys. It was this little Casio thing. And it was in a gym. And there were like 300 kids there. And they were first to third grade. Okay. That was when I realized two things. A, there is a limit to how crappy your instrument can be and still get your message across effectively. The reason why what we do is so amazing and so exquisite at its top level is because the piano itself is this amazing construction. You know, this hundreds of year old instrument that was, until the invention of the computer, the most sophisticated digital device ever created. Or a great violin, as you know, like there's nothing like the sound of a Stradivarius. It's unearthly, right? You need to have a good violin. You can't play on this horrible stick and actually make it deliver. And I realized that just playing music for these kids didn't work. I just started playing. I said, hi, I'm Albert. I'm going to play this piece. And I would play it for them. And you could just hear the sound level rising of like the shifting and the talking and the chattering. And I didn't know at the time that I could use the authority to say like, hey kids, we need to be quiet, right? And so then I went the other way and I was like, all right, kids, shut up. You know, like, you know, I'm Alvin, you know, and I was like, why aren't these kids listening to me? And that's when I arrived upon the idea that as a performer, you are training your audience as the concert progresses, right? The concert I did for you, the way I start usually by introducing myself is like, hi, I'm Alpin. I used to be a skater. I'm a video gamer. I'm a huge comic book geek. And so automatically, I'm not a pianist to begin with. I'm just a normal dude. I try to put myself across as a normal dude that has an extraordinary job. And I think that the connective part of that is only something that I learned by this and many numerous outreach failures that I had.
It's funny you talk about this, and I remember certain similar experiences when I was younger, and I remember so vividly how well you had captured the attention of other kids who were around the same age as me, maybe 8 or 9, and it was just so spectacular that for, I don't know what it was, maybe like an hour or so, that we were just entertained the entire time. So yeah, you just do such an amazing job at that.
I think it's very hard to do that, especially these days. I think it's true that all of us as a society, as humanity, have a shorter attention span than we ever had because digital media and others is coming to us ever more quickly. You even look at old movies and the shot stays the same, you know, sometimes for, you know, as long as 5 minutes, the camera angle won't change. And now the camera angle changes on average about every 5 seconds in order to keep your attention. So the idea that you're going to capture the attention of an audience and keep it focused on you, especially kids, for an hour is an exponential challenge. And as you saw it, I basically had to turn myself into a cartoon for you guys, right? I'm dashing all around, you know, for some of the audiences, I'm like jump kicking, like, you know, I'm flashing back for the playing snippets of stuff. Sometimes I'm not even playing whole pieces for you, you know, but just little things to keep you engaged and keep it in the front of your concentration. So yeah, that is something that is the unique challenge. And I think that is something that a lot of performers these days don't take into account, that in a generation when not everyone is as lucky as you and I to have had classical training and that perspective of doing it and appreciating what you're hearing and be able to listen for things, you have to be able to introduce the music to them. Doesn't necessarily have to be verbal, but sometimes even in the playing, the way you program it, you can't just throw the Brahms Handel variations for 30 minutes at an audience and just be like, see, isn't it amazing? You should clap, this stuff is awesome. Even for a sophisticated classical audience, you need an appetizer before you give them a main course.
I want to give you, you know, I think you do such a great job of doing these kind of outreach things. And I am wondering, is this kind of work what is the most meaningful to you? And do you feel like this has a greater impact on a wider variety of people and a larger number of people than, say, in a concert hall?
Well, I will say it doesn't pay as well. So that is something I think to keep in mind. Education, except for, you know, in the case of certain extraordinary institutions like the Gilmore that you're talking about, who put great stock in education and fund it. You know, they give it the funding and the attention that it deserves. And not every institution does that. There's nothing like playing with an orchestra in a great symphony hall on a $200,000 instrument. You can't compare that necessarily. But in terms of it like being more impactful, again, I was talking about the establishment of relationships being the, one of the greatest gifts that music has given me. Either was it's been through the colleagues or students like you that I've, you know, 10 years later, we're talking to each other, we're getting to know each other. Like, how awesome is this? We're separated by 10 years of time and 4,000 miles. That's the kind of thing that makes life worth living, right? I know a lot of musicians have only that concert side of it, and they're very lonely. They're at the top of the world, the you know, classical world, pop world, dance world, it doesn't matter. You know, you're at the top of the game and all you have that. But then after you're done with that concert, you go home, who do you hang with to celebrate? Who do you share that joy and the post-show glow with, if not other people like you, for example, you know, who understand that joy and understand what it is like to screw up and not have that joy, right? So that is how I think I distinguish the two in terms of the impact that it's given me. And the fact that some of my former students, like they are my online gamer friends right now that I log on every Wednesday to hack heads off of zombies and stuff, is, you know, just a side benefit of all that.
And this obviously looks very different. We are in an age where the whole world is just a different place than it was a year ago. And so I'm interested to hear, first of all, how you feel like this as a field, performing arts in general, has changed and evolved because of this pandemic that we are in. And then also how your life has changed. You had mentioned you're in Hawaii now, and yeah, kind of like what that looks like.
Well, as you know, as I don't need to explain, the level of the devastation that the pandemic has wreaked on the performing arts, there's nothing been quite like it, I think, in history. Even war didn't necessarily preclude people from gathering in numbers to enjoy something the way that this virus has. Outside of just the fact that the artists themselves are suffering personally, financially, artistically, because as those of us that do this for a living, a lot of us don't do this just for the money. I mean, we do this because we can't imagine doing anything else. And to have that part taken away, and the fact that so much, I was just talking about the connective tissue that the arts creates between people, to have that cut by this is devastating. And so it has really shown, actually, it separated the institutions, and especially the big ones. Those have been able to adapt and to be able to continue to create content and engage their audiences, and those that haven't. And what I've been really amazed to see and gratified to see is how smaller outfits have been very more nimble and agile, and were able to jump on being able to use technology to be able to continue to create and engage and retain their audiences. I myself had to go on video a bunch, and it's something that I hate most is recording and being on camera. Seeing myself play with, and for those of you that have seen me play, I emote a lot in my face because I can't help it. I'm just feeling these things. I emote a lot in my body. I'm like, you know, I'm at, you know, my wife calls me a man of large motions, you know, and this is, and never is that so apparent than when I'm at the piano. And, you know, to see that on camera within the strictures of a screen is really hard for me. Plus, the sound and power of a piano, to say nothing of a full orchestra, cannot be captured. Even with the finest recording instrument there is, there's something that just cannot be captured because the ear is so much a finer auditory capture device than any headphone or microphone could ever be. And so the loss of having that live concert, and I realized that the thing that we're all missing the most, even though we binged on Netflix and we've seen all of these Zoom concerts and all these kinds of things, is what we're missing is risk. There's a reason why the circus is so thrilling, because if that tightrope walker falls in front of you, you will see their body hit the ground if they're not having a net. And there's something so heart-wrenching about that and so emotive about that, that really can't be captured on camera. and all. So that has been, I think, the biggest challenge for me, is to be able to translate what I do live into like an online or video medium. But what has been great, though, I think, is that it has caused a lot of musicians and ensembles to once again rediscover their individual musicianship. A lot of my friends that play in orchestras, they hadn't been practicing for years, honestly. They would go, they would show up, they would rehearse, they would play the concerts, they would play at extremely high level because they're trained to do that. But they hadn't just sat home and kind of worked on themselves and their own artistic voice outside of the greater whole that they were making. And so some of them, not all, some of them have truly kind of managed to find that spark and that joy and that love of music making on their own that they might have forgotten about over the last few years.
I would love to continue this conversation for hours. I have learned so much from you, and just it's just incredible reconnecting after all of these years. I would love for my audience to know where to find you, how to, you know, hear the amazing recordings that you've made and see the cool things that you're up to.
Well, you can find me on YouTube, Alpin Hong. It's like Alpine without the E, H-O-N-G. You can find me on all the social media, you know, Facebook and Instagram. And they're mostly, it's just fun pictures and me swinging a lightsaber around with my children. But I think those are all performative as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on my podcast again. And thank you to those of you who have tuned in to the second episode. Please follow the podcast if you would like to know when future episodes come out. And tune in if you want to hear more from inspirational and amazing artistic leaders as you join me in my journey behind the curtain.
Thank you so much, Anna. I really love being here today.